reckless, because I was encroaching on the personal space of a grieving elephant mother, and I didn't give a flying fuck.
No,
Gideon said, figuring out exactly what I was up to.
You climb on.
So I did, wrapping my arms around him as we drove through the small opening in the fencing, into the enclosure with the elephant. Mora charged, flying toward us with her ears spread and her heavy feet thundering on the ground. I felt Gideon throw the ATV in reverse, but I put my hand on his arm.
Don't, I said. Turn it off.
He looked over his shoulder at me, wild-eyed, caught between obeying his boss's wife and his own instincts for self-preservation. The vehicle shuddered to a stop. So did Mora. Very slowly, I got off the ATV and pulled the heavy rubber tub from the flatbed on the back. I set this about 10 feet away from the vehicle and then poured several gallons of water inside. Then I climbed behind Gideon again.
Reverse, I whispered.
Now. He backed up as Mora's trunk twitched in our direction. She stepped closer and drank the whole tub of water at once. She angled herself so that her tusks were only inches away from my skin, close enough for me to see the nicks and scars on them from years of use, close enough for her to look me in the eye. Mora reached out with her trunk and stroked my shoulder. Then she lumbered back to the body of her calf and resumed her position, sheltering him. I felt Gideon's hand on my back. It was partly comfort, partly reverence.
Breathe,
he instructed. After 36 hours, the vultures came. They circled overhead like witches on their brooms. Every time they swooped, Mora would flap her ears and bellow, scaring them off. That night it was the fisher cats. Their eyes flashed neon green as they crept closer to the calf's body. Mora, coming out of her trance as if a switch had been flipped, ran at them with her tusks to the ground. Thomas had given up asking me to come home. Everyone had given up asking me. I would not leave until Mora was ready to leave. I would be her herd and remind her that she still had to live, even if her calf couldn't. The irony did not escape me. I was playing the role of the elephant, while Mora was acting rather human by refusing to stop grieving her dead son. One of the most amazing things about elephants mourning in the wild is their ability to grieve hard, but then truly, unequivocally, let go. Humans can't seem to do that. I've always thought it's because of religion. We expect to see our loved ones again in the next life, whatever that might be. Elephants don't have that hope, only the memories of this life. Maybe that's why it's easier for them to move on. 72 hours post-delivery, I tried to imitate the "let's go" rumble I'd heard 1,000 times in the wild and to point myself in that direction like an elephant would. Mora ignored me. By now, I could barely stand, and my vision was blurred. I hallucinated a bull elephant breaking through the fence, only to realize that it was an ATV approaching. On it rode Nevi and Gideon. Nevi looked at me and shook her head.
You're right, she's a mess,
Nevi said to Gideon. And then to me,
you're going back home. Your girl needs you. If you don't want to leave Mora alone, I'll stay with her.
Because Gideon didn't trust me to hang on to him without falling asleep, I did not climb behind him on the ATV. I sat in the circle of his arms, the way a child might have done, and nodded off until he parked in front of our cottage. Embarrassed, I leaped off the vehicle, thanked him quickly, and walked inside. To my surprise, Grace was asleep on the couch beside Jenna's crib,
which was in the middle of the living room since we didn't have space for a nursery. I woke her and told her to go home with Gideon, and then I went down the hall to Thomas's office. Like me, he was wearing the clothes he'd been wearing 3 days ago. He was bent over a ledger, so engrossed in what he was studying that he didn't notice I was there. A bottle of prescription medicine was spilled on its side on the desk, and a depleted bottle of whiskey sat sentinel beside him. I thought he might have fallen asleep working, but when I got closer, I saw that his eyes were wide open, glassy, sightless. "Thomas," I said softly, "let's go to sleep."
"Can't you see I'm busy?"
he said, so loud that in the other room the baby started to cry.
"Shut the fuck up,"
he yelled, and he lifted his book and threw it at the wall behind me. I ducked, then bent down to retrieve it. The pages fell open before me. Whatever had engrossed Thomas so deeply, it wasn't this book. This was an empty journal, one blank page following the next. I understood now why Grace had not felt comfortable leaving the baby alone with him. It was not until after we'd had our wedding ceremony in the Boone Town Hall that I found bottles of pills lined up like foot soldiers in Thomas's dresser. "Depression," he'd told me when I asked. After his father, his last surviving parent, had died, he could not muster the strength to get out of bed. I had nodded, trying to be compassionate. I was less unnerved by the news of his clinical despair than I was about the fact that I had entered into marriage with someone so quickly I did not even know his parents were both deceased. Thomas hadn't had another depressive episode since then that he'd told me about, but to be honest, I hadn't asked either. I wasn't sure I wanted to know the answer. Shaking, I backed out of the room and closed the door. I picked up Jenna, who quieted immediately, and carried her to the bed I shared with a stranger who happened to be the father of my child. Against all odds, I fell immediately into a deep, velvet sleep, my daughter's tiny hand caught like a fallen star in my own. When I woke up, the sun was a scalpel, and a fly was buzzing in my ear. I brushed at my temple, willing it to go away, only to realize it wasn't a fly, and I couldn't get rid of it. It was the distant sound of construction equipment, the backhoe we used to do landscaping work in the sanctuary. "Thomas?" I called, but he didn't answer. I scooped up Jenna, who was awake and smiling now, and carried her into his office. Thomas was at his desk, his face pressed to the blotter, completely unconscious. I watched his back rise and fall twice to make sure he was alive, then bundled Jenna into a sling on my back, the way I had learned from the African women who cooked at the camp in the reserve. I left the cottage, climbed on an ATV, and headed toward the northern edge of the sanctuary, where I had left Mora last night. The first thing I noticed was the hot wire. Mora paced back and forth in front of it, trumpeting and raging, jerking her head and tusking at the ground, coming as close to that wire as she could without it shocking her. Through all of these aggressive gestures, she never took her eye off her calf, which was chained onto a large wooden pallet beside Nevi, who was directing Gideon where to dig a grave. I drove the ATV through the gate, past Mora, and skidded to a stop a foot away from Nevi.
"What the hell do you think you're doing?"
She glanced at me and at the baby on my back, and with one look let me know what she thought of my mothering skills. "What we always do when an elephant dies. The necropsy samples were already taken this morning by the vet." Blood roared in my ears.
"You separated a grieving mother from her calf?"
It's been 3 days, Nevi said. This is for her own good. I've been with mothers who see their calves suffer, and it breaks them. It happened to Wimpy, and it will happen again if we don't do something about it. Is that what you want for Mora? What I want for Mora is for her to make the decision when it's time to let go, I shouted. I thought that was the whole philosophy of this sanctuary. I turned my face to Gideon, who had stopped digging with the construction equipment and was standing awkwardly to the side. Did you even ask Thomas? Yes, Nevi said, lifting her chin. He said he trusted me to know what to do. You don't know anything about how a mother grieves for her calf, I said. This isn't mercy. It's cruelty. What's done is done, Nevi argued. The sooner Mora doesn't have to see that calf, the sooner she'll forget what happened. She will never forget what happened, I promised. And neither will I. Not much later, Thomas woke up, subdued, his old self. He gave Nevi a dressing down for taking matters into her own hands, neatly erasing his own responsibility in the situation for giving her permission when he was not in a sound mental state to do so. He wept, apologizing to me and to Jenna for letting the demons in. Nevi, miffed, disappeared for the rest of the afternoon. Gideon and I removed the straps and the chains from the calf's body, although we did not attempt to slide him off the pallet. The moment I turned off the electricity on the hot wire, Mora tore it away as if it were made of straw and rushed toward her son. She stroked him with her trunk, backed up to him with her hind legs. She stood beside him for another 45 minutes, and then slowly lumbered into the birch forest, away from the calf. I waited 10 minutes, listening for her return, but it didn't happen. Okay, I said. Gideon climbed onto the backhoe and bit into the earth beneath the oak tree where Mora liked to rest. I strapped the calf's body onto the pallet again so that he could be lowered into the grave when it was deep enough. I took a shovel Gideon had brought and began to cover the body with dirt, a tiny gesture to add to the fill that Gideon was scooping with the excavator. By the time I patted down the overturned earth on top of the grave, rich as coffee grounds, my hair had fallen from its ponytail, and perspiration wringed my underarms and soaked my back. I was sore and exhausted, and the emotion I'd pushed away for the past 5 hours suddenly rushed over me, knocking me off my feet. I fell to my knees, sobbing. All of a sudden, Gideon was there, his arms around me. He was a big man, taller and broader than Thomas. I leaned into him, the way you press your cheek to solid ground after falling a great distance.
It's okay,
he said, although it wasn't. I couldn't bring Mora's baby back.
You were right. We never should have separated her from the calf.
I pulled back. Then why did you? He looked me in the eye.
Because sometimes, when I think for myself, I get into trouble.
I could feel his hands on my shoulders. I could smell the salt of his sweat. I looked at his skin, dark against mine.
Thought you might need this, Grace said. She was holding a jug of iced tea.
I did not know when Grace had come walking up. I did not know what she thought to find her husband comforting me. It was nothing more than that, yet we still jumped apart as if we had something to hide. I wiped my eyes with the hem of my shirt as Gideon reached out for the jug. Even when Gideon left, his hand in Grace's, I could feel the heat of his palms on me. It made me think of Mora standing over her calf,
trying to be a haven, when clearly it was already too late.
Jenna. When you're a kid, most people actively go out of their way to not notice you. Businessmen and businesswomen don't look, because they're wrapped up in their phone calls or texts or sending emails to their bosses. Mothers turn away because you're a glimpse into the future, when their sweet little porker of a baby will become another antisocial teenager, plugged into music and incapable of holding a conversation beyond grunts. The only folks who actually look me in the eye are lonely old ladies, or little kids who want attention. For this reason, it's incredibly easy to hop on a Greyhound without ever buying a ticket, which is pretty awesome because who has $190 lying around? I just hang out near the ragged edges of a family that can't keep itself together. There's a shrieking baby and a boy who's about 5 with his thumb jammed in his mouth, and a teenager texting so fast that I think her galaxy is going to burst into flames. When the boarding call to Boston is made and the frazzled parents try to count the luggage and their offspring, I follow their older daughter onto the bus like I belong with them. No one stops me. I know the driver's going to count heads before he pulls out of the station, so I immediately go to the bathroom and lock myself inside. I stay there until I can feel the wheels rolling, until Boone, New Hampshire is an afterthought. Then I slip into the rear seat of the bus, the one no one ever wants because it smells like the urinal cake, and pretend to be fast asleep. Let's talk for just a second about the fact that my grandmother is going to ground me until I'm, 60. I left her a note, but I've purposely turned off my phone because I don't really want to hear her reaction when she finds it. If she thinks that my internet searches for my mom are ruining my life, she's not going to be thrilled to hear that I'm stowing away on a bus bound for Tennessee so that I can track her in person. I'm a little pissed at myself, actually, for not thinking to do this before. Maybe it was my father's anger, totally out of character for a guy who spends most of his time virtually catatonic, that jogged my memory. Whatever it was, something fell into place so that I would remember Gideon and how important he was to me and my mother. The way my father had reacted to the pebble necklace was like a jolt of electricity, lighting up neurons that had simmered quietly for years, so that banners waved and neon signs flashed in my mind, "Pay attention." It's true that even if I had remembered Gideon before now, I still wouldn't have been able to figure out where he had gone 10 years ago. But I do know somewhere he stopped along the way. When my mother disappeared and my father's business was revealed to be bankrupt, the elephants were sent to the elephant sanctuary in Hohenwald, Tennessee. All you have to do is a quick Google search to read about how their board of directors, hearing about the New England sanctuary's plight, had scrambled to find space to house the homeless animals. Accompanying the elephants was the only employee who'd been left behind. Gideon. I didn't know if the sanctuary had hired him to continue caring for our animals, or if he had dropped the elephants off and moved on. If he had reunited with my mother. If they still held hands when they thought no one was looking. See, that's the other thing about people who think kids are invisible. They forget to be careful around you. I know it's stupid, but there was a big part of me that was hoping Gideon was there and had no idea where my mom was, in spite of the fact that this was the reason I was currently wedged on a bus with my sweatshirt hood drawn tight so no one would try to make eye contact with me, just so I could find this out. I couldn't really handle the thought that my mother had spent the past 10 years happy. I didn't wish her dead, and I didn't wish her life to be miserable. But I mean, shouldn't I have been part of that equation? Anyway, I'd run through the possible scenarios in my head. Number 1. Gideon was working at the sanctuary and was living with my mother, who'd taken on an alias like Mata Hari or Euphonia Lalique or something equally mysterious so that she could remain hidden. Note, I didn't really want to think about what she would be hiding from. My father? The law? Me? None of those were options I felt like exploring. Gideon would recognize me at first glance, of course, and take me to my mother, who would dissolve in an implosion of joy and beg forgiveness and tell me she'd never stop thinking of me. Number 2. Gideon was no longer working at the sanctuary, but given that the elephant community is a pretty small one, there was still some contact information for him in the files. I would show up on his doorstep, and my mother would answer the door, and then you can fill in the rest from scenario one. Number three. I finally found Gideon, wherever he was, but he told me he was sorry, that he had no idea what had happened to my mother. That yes, he had loved her. That yes, she had wanted to run away from my father with him. Maybe even that the death of Nevi was somehow tied to this star-crossed love affair. But that in the long years I had spent growing up, it simply had not worked out between them, and she had left him the same way she left me. That, of course, was the worst scenario of all. There was only one that was even more grim. It was so dark that I had let my imagination peek through a crack in its door, only to slam it shut before it spilled into every corner of my mind. Number four. Through Gideon, I locate my mother. But there is no joy. No reunion. No wonder. There's just resignation as she sighs and says, I wish you hadn't found me. Like I said, I'm not even going to think about that possibility. Just in case, as Serenity says, the energy sent out into the universe by a random thought can actually bring about an outcome. I don't think that it will take Virgil long to figure out where I've gone, or to come to the same conclusion I have, that Gideon is the connection to my mother, maybe the reason she ran away, maybe even the link to the accidental death that may not be an accident. And I feel a little bad about not telling Serenity where I'm headed. But then, she reads people for a living. I hope she can figure out that I have every intention of coming back. Just not alone. There are connections to be made in Boston, New York, and Cleveland. At each stop, I get off the bus holding my breath, certain that this is the one where I will find a cop waiting to take me home. But that would require my grandmother to report me missing, and let's face it, she doesn't have a great track record for that. I keep my phone turned off because I don't want her calling, or Virgil, or Serenity. I follow the same pattern at each bus terminal, looking for a family that might not notice me dangling from its fringe. I sleep, on and off, and play games with myself. If I see three consecutive red cars on I-95, it means my mother will be happy to see me. If I see a VW Beetle before I finish counting to 100, it means she ran away because she didn't have a choice. If I see a hearse, it means she's dead, and that's why she never came back to me. I don't see any hearses, just in case you're wondering. One day, 3 hours and 48 minutes after I leave Boone, New Hampshire, I find myself at the bus station in Nashville, Tennessee, stepping into a wave of heat that hits me like a knockout punch. The terminal is in the middle of the city, and I'm surprised by the amount of activity and noise. It's like walking into a headache. There are men wearing bolo ties and tourists nursing bottles of water and people playing the guitar for coins in front of storefronts. Everyone seems to be wearing cowboy boots. Immediately, I fade back into the air-conditioned terminal and find a map of Tennessee. Hohenwald, where the sanctuary is located, is southwest of the city, about an hour and a half away. I'm guessing it's not a big tourist destination, so there's no public transport out there, and I'm not stupid enough to hitchhike. Is it possible that getting this last 80 miles will be harder than the 1,000 before it? For a little while, I stand in front of the giant map of Tennessee that is on the wall, wondering why American kids never study geography, because if they did, maybe I'd have a working knowledge of this state. I take a deep breath and walk out of the bus station, downtown, wandering in and out of stores selling Western attire and restaurants with live music. There are also cars and trucks parked along the streets. I look at the license plates. A lot are probably rentals, but some have baby car seats inside, or CDs scattered on the floor. The detritus of an owner. Then I start reading bumper stickers. There are some I expect. American by birth, Southern by the grace of God, and some that make me feel sick to my stomach. Save a deer, shoot a queer. But I am looking for hints, clues, the way Virgil might have looked. Something that will tell me more about the family who owns that vehicle. Finally, on one pickup truck, I find a sticker that says, Proud of my Columbia Honor Student. This is a jackpot on two counts. There is a flatbed I can hide in, and Columbia, according to the map at the Greyhound terminal, is en route to Hohenwald. I put my foot on the rear bumper, ready to hoist myself into the flatbed and lie down when no one is looking.
What are you doing?
I've been so busy canvassing the people on the street to see if they're paying attention. I don't see the little boy sneak up behind me. He's probably about 7 years old, and he's missing so many of his teeth that the remaining ones look like headstones in a graveyard. I crouch down, thinking of all the babysitting I've done over the years.
I'm playing hide and seek. Want to help?
He nods.
Cool. But that means you have to keep a secret. Can you do that? Can you not tell your mom or dad that I'm hiding here?
The boy jerks his chin up and down, emphatic.
Then do I get to have a turn?
Totally, I promise. And I hike myself into the flatbed.
Brian!
A woman calls, huffing as she runs around the corner, a teenage girl sulking behind her with her arms crossed.
Get over here!
The metal bed is as hot as the surface of the sun. I can literally feel the blisters forming on my palms and the backs of my legs. I poke my head up the tiniest bit so that I can make eye contact with him, and I put my finger to my pursed lips, the universal sign for shh. His mother is closing in on us, so I lie down and cross my arms and hold my breath.
My turn next,
Brian says.
Who are you talking to?
His mother demands.
My new friend. I thought we talked about lying,
she says, and she unlocks the cab door. I feel bad for Brian, not just because his mother doesn't believe him, but because I have no plans to give him a turn at hide-and-seek. I'll be long gone by then. Someone inside slides open the back window of the truck cab for ventilation. Through it, I can hear the radio as Brian and his sister and his mom head down the interstate toward, I hope, Columbia, Tennessee. I close my eyes as the sun bakes me and pretend I am on a beach, not a slab of metal. The songs that come on are about driving trucks like this one, or about girls with hearts of gold who've been done wrong. They all sound the same to me. My mother had an aversion to banjos so strong it bordered on allergy. I remember her turning off the radio every time a singer had the slightest twang in her voice. Could a woman who hated country western music have chosen to make a new home within striking distance of the Grand Old Opry? Or had she used that dislike as a smokescreen, figuring that anyone who knew her would never expect her to settle down in the heart of country western land? As I bob along in the flatbed, I think, one, banjos actually are kind of cool. Two, maybe people change.
Alice. It's really not a stretch to say that, for elephants, mating is a song and dance. As in all communication for those animals, vocalizations are paired with gestures. On an ordinary day, for example, a matriarch might make a "let's go" rumble, but at the same time, she will position her body in the direction she wants to take the herd. The sounds of mating are more complicated, however. In the wild, we hear the pulsing, guttural must rumbles of males, deep and low, puttering. What you might imagine if you drew a bow made of hormones against an instrument of anger. Males might produce a must rumble when they are challenged by another male, when they're surprised by an approaching vehicle, when they are searching for mates. The sounds differ from elephant to elephant, and are accompanied by ear waves and frequent urine dribbling. When a must male is vocalizing, the whole herd of females will start to chorus. Those sounds attract not just the male who started the conversation, but all the eligible bachelors, so that the females in estrus now have the chance to choose the most attractive mate. And by this I don't mean the one with the best comb-over, but rather the male who is most likely to survive, a healthy, older elephant. A female that doesn't like a particular male might run away from him, even if he has already mounted her, to find someone better. But of course, that presumes there's someone better to be found. For this reason, several days before she comes into estrus, a female gives an estrus roar, a powerful call that brings even more boys to the yard, and thus a greater range of mates from which to select. Finally, when she allows herself to be mated, she sings an estrus song. Unlike the must rumbles of males, these songs are lyrical and repetitive, throaty purrs that rise quickly and then trail off. The female flaps her ears loudly and secretes from her temporal glands. After the mating, the other females in her family join in, a symphony of roars and rumbles and trumpets like those they'd make at any other socially exciting moment, a birth or a reunion. We know that when male whales sing, those who have the most complex songs are the ones who get the females. On the contrary, in the elephant world, a must male will mate with anyone he can. It's the female who sings, and it's out of biological necessity. A female elephant is in estrus for only 6 days, and the only available males may be miles away. Pheromones don't work at those distances, so she has to do something else to attract potential mates. It has been proven that whale songs are passed down from generation to generation, that they exist in all the oceans of the world. I have always wondered if the same holds true for elephants, if the calves of elephants learned the estrus song from their older female relatives during mating season, so that when it's their own turn, they know how to sing to attract the strongest, fiercest males. If, by doing this, the daughters learn from their mother's mistakes.
Serenity. Here's what I haven't told you. Once before, in my heyday as a psychic, I lost the ability to communicate with spirits. I was doing a reading for a young college girl who wanted me to reach out to her deceased dad. She brought along her mother, and they had their own tape recorders, so that each could replay whatever happened at our session. For an hour and a half, I put his name out there. I struggled to connect. And the only thought that came into my head was that this man had killed himself with a gun. Other than that, silence. Exactly like what I get now when I try to connect with the dead. Anyway, I felt horrible. I was charging these women for 90 minutes of nothing. And although I didn't offer a money-back guarantee, I had never in my life as a psychic come up so dry before. So I apologized. Upset about the outcome, the girl burst into tears and asked to use the restroom. As soon as she left, her mother, who had been largely silent during this entire experience, told me about her husband and the secret she had not confided to her daughter. He had indeed committed suicide, using a shotgun. He'd been a very well-known college basketball coach in North Carolina who'd had an affair with one of the boys on his team. When his wife discovered this, she told him she wanted a divorce and that she would ruin his professional career unless he paid her to keep quiet. He refused and said he truly cared about the boy. So she told her husband he could have his new paramour, but she would sue him for every cent he had and would still go public with what he'd done to her. That was the cost of love, she said. He walked downstairs into their basement and blew his brains out. At his funeral, as she was saying her last goodbye in private, she said, "You son of a bitch. Don't think I'll forgive you now that you're dead. Good riddance." 2 days later, the daughter called me to say that the strangest thing had happened. The recording she had made was completely blank. Although there had been dialogue between us during the session, all you could hear on the playback was a hissing sound. And even stranger, the same thing was true of the recording that had been made by her mother. It was clear to me that the dead husband had heard his wife loud and clear at the funeral and had taken her at her word. She didn't want anything to do with him, and so he stayed away from us all, permanently. Talking to spirits is a dialogue. It takes two. If you're trying hard and coming up empty, it's either because of a spirit who won't communicate or because of a medium who can't. It does not work like a faucet, I snap, trying to put some distance between myself and Virgil. I can't turn it on and off. We are in the parking lot outside of Gordon's Wholesale, processing the information we just received about Grace Cartwright's suicide. I have to admit, it wasn't what I was expecting to hear. But Virgil is convinced that this is an integral piece of the puzzle.
Let me get this straight, he says soberly. I'm saying to you that I'm willing to actually admit that psychic powers aren't a load of bullshit. I'm saying to you that I'm willing to give your talent a chance, and you won't even try?
Fine, I say, frustrated. I lean against the front bumper of my car, shaking out my shoulders and arms the way a swimmer does at the starting block. Then I close my eyes.
You can do it here?
Virgil interrupts. I crack open my left eye.
Isn't that what you had in mind?
His face reddens.
I guess I thought you'd need, I don't know, a tent or something.
I can manage without my crystal ball and tea leaves, too, I say dryly. I haven't admitted to either Jenna or Virgil that I can no longer communicate with spirits. I've let them believe that the acts of stumbling over Alice's wallet and necklace on the grounds of the old elephant sanctuary were not flukes, but actual psychic moments. I may have even convinced myself of that. So I close my eyes and think, Grace, Grace, come talk to me. That's how I used to do it. But I'm getting nothing. It's as empty and static as the time I tried to contact that North Carolina basketball coach who'd killed himself. I glance at Virgil.
You get anything?
I ask. He's typing away on his phone, searching for Gideon Cartwright in Tennessee.
Nope, he admits. But if I were him, I'd be using an alias.
Well, I'm not getting anything either, I tell Virgil, and this is, for once, the truth.
Maybe you should do it louder.
I put my hand on my hip.
Do I tell you how to do your job?
I say.
It's sometimes like this, for suicides.
Like what?
Like they're embarrassed by what they've done.
Suicides, almost by definition, are all ghosts. Stuck earthbound, because they are desperate to apologize to their loved ones, or because they are so ashamed of themselves. It gets me thinking about Alice Metcalf again. Maybe the reason I haven't been able to communicate with her is that, like Grace, she killed herself. Immediately I push that thought away. I've let Virgil's expectations go to my head.
The reason I haven't been able to contact Alice, or any other potential spirit for that matter, has a hell of a lot more to do with me than it does with them.
I'll try again later, I lie.
What is it you want from Grace, anyway?
I want to know what made her kill herself, he says.
Why would a happily married woman with a steady job and a family put stones in her pockets and walk into a pond?
Because she wasn't a happily married woman, I reply.
And we have a winner, Virgil says. You find out your husband is sleeping with someone else. What do? Take a blessed moment and glory in the fact that at least I walked down the aisle at some point?
Virgil sighs.
No. You confront him, or you run away.
I unravel that thought.
What if Gideon wanted a divorce, and Grace said no? What if he killed her and tried to make it look like a suicide?
The medical examiner would have figured out right away during the autopsy if it was a homicide rather than a suicide.
Really?
because I was under the impression that law enforcement doesn't always make the most legitimate rulings when it comes to cause of death. Virgil ignores my jab. What if Gideon was planning to run away with Alice, and Thomas found out about it? You had Thomas signed into the psychiatric ward before Alice disappeared from the hospital. But he very well could have been fighting with her earlier that night, so that she ran into the enclosures. Maybe Nevi Rule was in the wrong place at the wrong time. She tried to stop Thomas, and instead, he stopped her. Meanwhile, Alice ran, knocked her head into a branch, and passed out a mile away from them. Gideon met her at the hospital, and they worked out a plan, one that took her far away from her angry husband. We know that Gideon accompanied the elephants to their new home. Maybe Alice slipped away and met him there. I fold my arms, impressed. That's brilliant. Unless, Virgil muses, it went down another way. Say Gideon told Grace he wanted a divorce, so he could run off with Alice. Grace, devastated, committed suicide. The guilt over Grace's death made Alice rethink their plan. But Gideon wasn't willing to let her desert him. Not alive, anyway. I think about that for a moment. Gideon could have come to the hospital and convinced Alice that her baby was in trouble, or told her any lie that would have made her leave abruptly with him. I'm not stupid. I watch Law and Order. So many murders happen because the victim trusts the guy who comes to the door, or asks for help, or offers a ride. Then how did Nevi die? Gideon killed her, too. Why would he kill his own mother-in-law? I ask. You're kidding, right? Virgil says. Isn't that every guy's fantasy? If Nevi heard that Gideon and Alice were sleeping together, she probably was the one who started the fight. Or maybe she never touched Gideon. Maybe she went after Alice in the enclosure, and Alice ran away to save herself and passed out. I glance at him, which is what Jenna has been saying all along. Don't look at me like that, Virgil says and scowls. You should call her. She might remember something about Gideon and her mother. We don't need Jenna's help. We just have to get to Nashville. She doesn't deserve to be left behind. For a moment, Virgil looks like he's going to argue. Then he reaches for his phone and stares down at it. Do you have her number? I called her once, but it was from home, not my cell. I don't have her number with me. Unlike Virgil, however, I know where to look for it. We drive to my apartment. He glances with longing at the bar that we have to walk past to access the staircase. How do you resist? He murmurs. It's like living above a Chinese restaurant. Virgil stands in the doorway as I rummage through the stack of mail on my dining room table to find the ledger that I make my client sign. Jenna, of course, was the most recent acquisition. You can come in, you know, I say. It takes me another moment to locate the phone, which is hiding underneath a kitchen towel on the counter. I pick it up and punch Jenna's number in, but the phone doesn't seem to have a dial tone. Virgil is looking at the photograph on my mantle. Me, sandwiched between George and Barbara Bush. Nice of you to go slumming with the likes of Jenna and me, he says. I was a different person back then, I reply. Besides, celebrity isn't what it's cracked up to be. You can't see it in the photo, but the president's hand is on my ass. Could have been worse, Virgil murmurs. Could have been Barbara's. I try Jenna's number again, but nothing happens. Weird. There's something wrong with my line, I tell Virgil, who pulls his cell phone from his pocket. Let me try, he suggests. Forget it. I can't get cell service here unless I'm wearing tinfoil on my head and hanging from the fire escape. The joys of country living. We could use the phone at the bar, Virgil offers. The hell with that.
I say, imagining myself trying to pry him away from a whiskey. You used to be a beat cop before you were a detective, right?
Yeah.
I stuff the ledger into my purse. Then you can direct us to Greenleaf Street. The neighborhood where Jenna lives is like 100 other neighborhoods. Lawns trimmed neatly in patchwork squares. Houses dressed in red and black shutters. Dogs yapping behind invisible fences. Little kids ride their bikes up and down the sidewalk as I pull the car to the curb. Virgil glances at Jenna's front yard.
You can tell a lot about a person from their house, he muses.
Like what?
Oh, you know. A flag often means they're conservative. If they drive a Prius, they're going to be more liberal. Half the time it's bullshit, but it's an interesting science.
Sounds a lot like cold reading.
And I'm pretty sure it's about as accurate. Well, for what it's worth, I guess I didn't expect Jenna to grow up so white bread, if you know what I mean.
I do. The cul-de-sac, the meticulous houses, the recycling bins stacked at the curb, the 2.4 children in each yard. It feels so Stepford. There's something unsettled about Jenna, something ragged at the edges that does not belong here.
What's her grandmother's name? I ask Virgil. How the fuck would I know? He says. But it doesn't matter. She works during the day.
Then you should stay here, I suggest to Virgil.
Why?
Because I have less of a chance of Jenna slamming the door in my face if you're not with me, I say. Virgil may be a pain in the butt, but he isn't stupid. He slouches in the passenger seat.
Whatever.
So I walk solo up the cobblestone pathway to the front door. It's mauve, and there's a little wooden heart nailed to the front of it, painted with the words, Welcome, friends. I ring the doorbell, and a moment later it swings open by itself. At least that's what I think, until I realize that there's a tiny kid standing in front of me, sucking his thumb. He's maybe 3, and I am not all that good with small humans. They make me think of rodents, chewing your good leather shoes and leaving crumbs and droppings behind. I'm so stunned by the thought that Jenna has a sibling, one that was apparently born after she moved in with her grandmother, that I can't even find the words to say hello. The kid's thumb comes out of his mouth, like the plug from a dike, and, not surprisingly, the waterworks start. Immediately, a young woman comes running and scoops him into her arms.
I'm sorry, she says. I didn't hear the doorbell. Can I help you?
She is screaming this, of course, because the kid is wailing even louder. And she's already glaring at me, as if I actually did physical harm to her kid. Meanwhile, I'm trying to figure out who this woman is and what she is doing in Jenna's home. I offer my prettiest television smile.
I guess I came at a bad time, I say, loudly. I'm looking for Jenna.
Jenna?
Metcalf? I say.
The woman jostles her kid on her hip. I think you have the wrong address. She starts to close the door, but I wedge my foot inside it, digging in my purse for that ledger. It opens easily to the back page, where Jenna has written, in her loopy teenager handwriting, 145 Greenleaf Street, Boone.
145 Greenleaf Street? I ask. You've got the right place, she answers. But there's no one here by that name.
She shuts the door in my face, and I stare down at the ledger in my hand. Stunned, I walk back to the car and slip inside, toss the ledger at Virgil.
She played me, I tell him. She gave me a fake address.
Why would she do that?
I shake my head.
I don't know.
Maybe she didn't want me to send junk mail. Or maybe she didn't trust you, Virgil suggested. She doesn't trust either of us, and you know what that means.
He waits until I glance up at him.
She's a step ahead of us.
What do you mean?
She's smart enough to have figured out why her dad reacted the way he did. She must already know about her mother and Gideon. And she's doing exactly what we should have done an hour ago.
He reaches over and turns the key in the ignition.
We're going to Tennessee, Virgil says. Because $100 says Jenna's already there.
Alice. Dying of grief is the ultimate sacrifice, but it is not evolutionarily feasible. If grief were that overwhelming, a species would simply be erased. That's not to say there haven't been cases in the animal kingdom. I knew of a horse that had died suddenly, and its long-term stablemate followed shortly after. There was a pair of dolphins that had worked in tandem at a theme park. When the female passed away, the male swam in circles with his eyes closed for weeks. After Mora's baby died, her pain was written all over her face and in the way she moved her body gingerly, as if the friction of the air against it was excruciating. She isolated herself in the vicinity of the grave. She wouldn't come into the barn at night. She didn't have the solace of her family around her to bring her back to the world of the living. I was determined not to let her be a casualty of her own sorrow. Gideon affixed to the fence a giant bristled brush that had been a gift from the Public Works Department when it purchased a new street sweeper, an enrichment tool that Mora would have previously loved to rub up against. But Mora didn't even glance in the direction of the hammering when he was installing it. Grace tried to cheer Mora up by giving her red grapes and watermelon, her favorite foods, but Mora stopped eating. The vacancy of her stare, the way she seemed to take up less material space than she had before, it made me think of Thomas, staring down at the blank book in his office 3 nights after the calf's death, physically present, but mentally somewhere else. Nevi thought we should let Hester into the enclosure to see if she could console Mora, but I didn't think it was the right time yet. I had seen matriarchs charge elephants in their own herd, close relatives, if they got too close to a calf that was alive. Who knew what Mora, in her grief, would do to protect a calf that was dead? Not yet, I told Nevi. As soon as I see that she's ready to move on. It was academically interesting, recording how a lone elephant would rebound from loss without a herd to support her. It was also heartbreaking. I spent hours cataloging Mora's behavior because that was my job. I would take Jenna with me whenever Grace couldn't keep an eye on her because Thomas was so busy himself. Whereas the rest of us were still moving in slow motion, trapped by the viscous sadness that surrounded Mora, Thomas had snapped back into a model of efficiency. He was so focused and energized that I wondered if I'd just hallucinated the image of him catatonic at his desk the night after the calf died. The money he'd been counting on from donors who were excited about a baby elephant's arrival would no longer materialize, but he had a new idea to sustain funding, and that consumed him. If I was going to be honest, I didn't mind picking up the slack of running the sanctuary while Thomas was busy. Anything was better than the shock of seeing him the way he'd been, broken and unreachable. That Thomas, the one who had apparently existed before I knew him, was one I didn't ever want to see again. I hoped that maybe I was the necessary ingredient in that equation, that my presence was enough to keep his depression from returning in the future. And because I was unwilling to be the trigger that might set Thomas off, I was willing to do whatever he wanted or needed. I was going to be his biggest cheerleader. 2 weeks after the calf died, which is how I'd started marking time, I drove to Gordon's Wholesale to pick up our weekly order. But when I went to pay with our credit card, it was declined. "Run it again," I suggested, but it didn't make a difference. Embarrassed, it wasn't a state secret that the sanctuary was always low on funding, I told Gordon I'd just drive to an ATM and pay him in cash. When I tried, however, the machine wouldn't spit out any money. Account closed, the screen read. I ducked inside the bank and asked to speak to a manager. Surely there was a mistake. Your husband withdrew the money in that account, the woman told me. When? I asked, dumbfounded. She checked her computer. Last Thursday, she told me. The same day he applied for a second mortgage. My face burned. I was Thomas's wife. How could he make decisions like this without talking to me about them? We had 7 elephants whose diet was going to be seriously depleted without this week's produce delivery. We had 3 employees who expected to be paid on Friday, and as far as I could tell, we no longer had any money. I didn't go back to Gordon's Wholesale. Instead, I drove home, snapping Jenna out of her car seat so fast that she started to cry. I burst through the door of the cottage, calling for Thomas, who didn't answer. I found Grace cutting up squash in the Asian barn, and Nevi pruning wild grapevines, but neither of them had seen Thomas. By the time I walked back home, Gideon was waiting.
"You know anything about a nursery shipment?"
he asked. "Nursery," I repeated, thinking of babies, of Mora.
"Yeah, like plants."
"Don't accept the delivery," I said. "Stall them." Just then, Thomas walked past us, waving the truck through the gates. I handed Gideon the baby and grabbed Thomas by the arm. "Do you have a minute?"
"Actually," he said, "I don't."
"I think you do," I countered, and I dragged him inside to his office, closing the door for privacy. "What's on that truck?"
"Orchids," Thomas said. "Can't you picture it? A field of purple orchids stretching out to the Asian barn." He grinned. "I dreamed about it."
He'd bought a truckload of exotic flowers that we didn't need because of a dream. Orchids would not grow in this soil, and they were not cheap. That delivery was money thrown away. "You bought flowers? When our credit card's been shut off and our bank account has been drained?" To my shock, Thomas's face glowed.
"I didn't just buy flowers. I invested in the future. I don't know why I haven't thought of it before, Alice," he said. "The storage space above the African barn, I'm going to make it an observation deck."
He was talking so fast that his words tangled like yarn rolling out of his lap.
"You can see everything from up there, the whole property. I feel like I'm king of the world when I look out the window. Imagine 10 windows, a wall of glass, and big donors coming to watch the elephants from that deck, or renting out the space for functions."
It wasn't a bad idea, but it was an ill-timed one. We didn't have any extra funds to allocate to a renovation project. We barely had enough to cover operating expenses for the month. "Thomas, we can't afford that."
"We can if we don't hire anyone to do the building."
"Gideon doesn't have time to..."
"Gideon?" He laughed. "I don't need Gideon. I can do it myself."
"How?" I asked. "You don't know anything about construction." He turned on me. "Feral."
"You don't know anything about me."
As I watched him walk out the office door, I thought that might just be true. I told Gideon that there had been a mistake, that the orchids needed to be returned. I'm still not sure how he managed this miracle, but he came back with the refunded money in hand, which went directly to Gordon's Wholesale for our crates of cabbage and thick-necked squash and overripe melons. Thomas didn't even seem to realize that his orchids were gone. He was too busy hammering and sawing in the old attic space above the African barn from dawn to dusk. And yet every time I asked to see his progress, he snapped at me. Maybe, I thought scientifically, this was Thomas's reaction to grief. Maybe he was throwing himself into a project so that he wouldn't think about what we'd lost. To that end, I decided the best way to snap him out of his folly was to help him remember what he still had. So I cooked elaborate meals, even though I'd never really mastered more than macaroni and cheese. I packed picnics and brought Jenna to the African barn and enticed Thomas